www.lifeaudience.org.
From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, Dr. Philip Landrigan is a professor of environmental medicine, public health, and pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. He, along with his wife Mary, have co-authored a book titled Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know.
The book looks at the numerous settings and situations where children are exposed to chemicals in everyday life. Many of these chemicals are suspected or known carcinogens, and thousands more have never been tested by the manufacturer to determine their long or short-term health impacts on children.
Dr. Philip Landrigan joins us in the first part of the show to discuss the links between toxic chemicals in the environment and disease in children.
Then in the second half of the show, Peter Metcalf, the founder and CEO emeritus of Black Diamond Equipment, will stop by to talk about the remarks he gave at the annual Outdoor Retailer and Snow Show at its new home in Denver.
He'll also share with us his involvement in the making of a documentary about our public lands and shrinking national monuments, most notably Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante.
Well, we don't take phone calls during the show, but remember you can join in on today's discussion by emailing your comments and questions to thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649. Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, E-S-C-O.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And we are waiting for Dr. Philip Landrigan to join us to talk about his book that he co-authored with his wife, Mary, titled Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know. Of course, live radio. Dr. Landrigan is a little indisposed right now at a meeting, so we're going to do our best to try to get in touch with him, get him on the phone as soon as he's out of that meeting. Otherwise, we're going to have to fill in for a little bit as best
we
can.
That's right, and we do have some exciting news.
What?
That Squaw
really?
Valley and Alpine Meadows.
That's right.
Two ski resorts in the Tahoe area have just made a big announcement, which is that they hope to use 100% renewable energy by December 2018.
What? December 2018?
Yeah. So
that would be this year.
They're working with regional electricity provider Liberty Utilities to identify and develop new renewable energy generation, storage, and energy efficiency projects, primarily solar, that will provide clean energy to the region. And subject to regulatory approval, the two companies intend to achieve the resort's 100% renewable energy goal as early as December 2018. That is a tight timeline.
That's a tight timeline.
They must have been working on this and laying their groundwork.
They may be more than halfway there already, right, through other efforts and such.
Yeah, and so they're looking at two huge projects, a 50-megawatt solar generation plant and then a recently approved 10-megawatt solar facility. And that'll all go to these ski resorts to help
power
them. So it's kind of neat to see. We've heard big announcements from Vail as far as their sustainability and
other ski resorts looking to do the same, as well as municipalities like Park City and Summit County. And there was an interesting article in today's New York Times about Xcel Energy, which has does a lot of energy supply in the Colorado area, and they're finding that their RFPs, their proposals coming from renewable energy companies is actually less than on a kilowatt per hour basis than the coal industries. So that's great news too. And here's some other good news. Really good news.
The best news of the morning.
Is that we have Dr. Philip Landrigan on the line joining us from, I believe, in Boston, where he's attending a meeting. He joins us to talk about his book that he and his wife Mary co-authored titled Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know. Dr. Landrigan, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you and to come into the Intermountain West.
Yes. let's start. The book is really interesting, and I love the way it's written in a simple Q&A format. And it's actually really easy for us as hosts. We could just ask you the questions that are in your book. But let's start literally on chapter one. You talk about how the types of diseases that have infected or confronted children have changed over the years from communicable and infectious types of diseases to more non-communicable diseases. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So if you go back, let's say about 75 years in this country, the major diseases of children, the major killers of children, were measles, cholera, polio, scarlet fever, all of them infectious diseases. And those are still the major killers of children in the world's poorest countries. Mm. But what's changed over the past 50 years is that we've brought those infectious diseases, communicable diseases, under control through vaccines, through better treatment of sick children. And the consequence is that even though their infectious diseases are still out there and we're still dealing with terrible infectious problems like AIDS and TB, they don't have the massive impact on children's mortality that they used to. And so today, the major diseases that make children sick and that sometimes kill children are non-communicable diseases, asthma, learning disabilities, birth defects, childhood cancer, and more recently, obesity and diabetes.
Yeah, and what I found interesting is that almost 80%, 80 to 90% of diseases that are cancers that are infecting children, particularly leukemia, cases of leukemia are actually increasing?
Cancer in children is a good news and a bad news story. The good news is that we've done a marvelous job of learning how to treat childhood cancer.
Yeah.
When I was a medical intern and resident, which was around 1970, every single child who came into the hospital with cancer died.
Wow.
Without exception. Today, depending on where a child is treated, 75-80% of children diagnosed with leukemia will survive. 50-60% of children with brain cancer, which is the other big childhood cancer, they'll survive. So we've really done a marvelous job on survival, which means that the cancer death rates are down. But even as that's been happening, the incidence of childhood cancer, which means the number of new cases per 1,000 children, has been rising steadily. Hmm. And since we started keeping national statistics, which was in the early 1970s, we've seen approximately a 40% increase in the incidence of childhood cancer in this country.
And and is there any way of connecting these increases in blood and brain cancers with chemicals in our environment?
We've connected certain cancers to chemicals. For example, benzene exposure can cause leukemia and lymphoma.
Right.
A chemical called 1,3-butadiene, which is a major component of synthetic rubber, causes leukemia. Radiation is well known to cause leukemia, lymphoma, brain cancer, and other forms of cancer. That said, I don't think anybody has a good, coherent explanation of why cancer rates have increased so substantially over the past 40 or 50 years. A little bit of it is better diagnosis, no question. That's a bit of the story, but not a major part. The major part of the increase is really of unknown cause. We can speculate that it may be due to chemicals, but I don't have hard data.
So we're speculating that a lot of this is due to chemicals. How many chemicals are out there in our world, in our society, that aren't tested, that we don't know what the impacts are?
Yeah, well, that's, the short answer is an enormous number. According to the U.S. EPA, something like 85,000 chemicals are registered for commercial use in this country. The ones that really matter for children's health are approximately 5,000 chemicals. These are what EPA calls high production volume chemicals. And these are the chemicals that are widely used in toys, in children's products, in furniture, in cars, in construction, in everything that we use in today's life. And it's important, I should say, that many of these chemicals have benefited us. Think about new drugs, new medications, cancer treatments, antibiotics. Think about new construction materials that enable us to build buildings that we could only dream of 50 years ago, lightweight materials that go into airplanes and so on. That's all to the good. But the bad side here is that despite all of our ingenuity in devising and inventing new chemicals and finding uses for them, we've done a terrible job as a society of exercising any kind of stewardship over this chemical revolution. So we brought these chemicals to market. We blithely assume that they're safe, that they won't cause any harm. And then time and time and time again, we find that chemicals have actually caused damage to children. They've caused degradation of the environment, like DDT. And it's a broken system that we allow chemicals to come on the market without testing them. More than half the chemicals on the market have never been tested, or at least they have no publicly available test data. And approximately 80% of the chemicals on the market have never been tested to determine whether they have negative effects on children's early development.
Well, I was just going to ask about that. So what does the process look like when a company wants to bring a new chemical to market, when they want to, you know, use a new chemical in a product that they're selling? What are they required to do?
They're required to notify EPA that they're bringing out a new chemical product. There's a form that they have to fill out and send to EPA. And in theory, EPA is supposed to look over that form and then see if there's any red flags. But in reality, companies file the form, nothing happens, and they bring the chemical to market. In the past 40 years, only about 5 chemicals have been pulled off the American market because of health concerns or environmental concerns.
Wow.
Basically, the office at EPA that is supposed to safeguard chemicals is actually toothless.
And I'm going to assume that toothlessness is even more so under this present administration, without being too leading.
The short answer to that is yes.
Okay, thank you. And it's interesting, though, but chemicals like you noted benzene, let's say, that's a known carcinogen under the EPA's definition.
Yes, it has been since the 1970s or 80s, yes.
Right, yet it's still on the market. It's still an additive, or it's a component in gasoline and diesel. And
correct, that's correct.
But so that's a challenge. As much as we know about the harm associated with benzene, for example, you can't take it off the market wholesale.
No. I mean, people have tried safer alternatives, but you're correct that there's a lot of these chemicals are still marketed. Now, in some cases, the states take the lead in controlling exposure to chemicals. When the federal government won't act or can't act or fails to act, the states are able to step in. And I think California has been a leader in this. They've got Proposition 65 in California, which passed many years ago by referendum. And under Prop 65, the state has the power to review chemicals that are coming onto the market. And if they determine that a chemical can cause cancer, can cause birth defects, the manufacturer is required to prominently place a notice at the point of sale. And for example, that's true when you purchase gasoline in California. But not many other states have gone that route.
Hmm.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Philip Landrigan, who's a professor of environmental medicine, public health, and pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and also author, along with his wife, of the new book titled Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know. So, Dr. Landrigan, are there lessons that we can learn from the actions that states like California are taking? Are they seeing yet any measurable impacts on health, or is that way too difficult to monitor?
Yeah, California has certainly done a marvelous job of cleaning up their air. The air in Los Angeles is a lot cleaner than it used to be, and studies of children's lung development are showing that children are definitely healthier, having better lung development, less asthma, less pulmonary disease than they did in the past. So I think the answer to your question is that action taken at the state and local level can indeed make a big difference to protect children against toxic chemicals.
I've had a couple experiences with chemicals and infectious diseases. I had a younger brother who passed away from leukemia at age 2 back in 1958. And, of course, you know, doctor, back in the 50s, we turned our, chemicals became a kind of a panacea to solve a lot of our problems, our growing, economy and health and welfare was going to rely heavily on chemicals, right? And I no doubt that perhaps my brother's contraction of leukemia had something to do with that.
Leukemia was, it was sold in little bottles as a spot remover around the home. And the phrase better living through chemistry was quite common at that time.
Right. And then along comes Rachel Carson, who helps illuminate the impacts and consequences associated with overuse of chemicals, et cetera. And that helped change a lot of minds and policy. The other thing that's interesting is that I, as an environmental engineer, I did a lot of work down in South Florida, and we would go into schools, and we would see maybe asbestos in the insulation or in the tile, lead paint on the windowsills or so, and water damage. And a lot of times, the most alarming thing that we saw, or the thing that we would address quickly, would be the water damage, because water damage, particularly in places like warm, humid environments, meant mold and black mold and other types of mold. And mold will do a lot of harm quickly, correct?
Yes, mold is a potent trigger for asthma in children.
Yeah, so it was important to address issues like that quickly, because I'd walk in. Go ahead.
Those other problems that you mentioned are very important too. So asbestos is a human carcinogen.
It
causes multiple forms of cancer. And lead, of course, can cause lead poisoning, which reduces a child's IQ, shortens their attention span, seriously can disrupt their behavior. So, yes, these are important chemicals.
Yeah, they all need to be addressed. Right.
So what kinds of, laws are out there that govern the use of these chemicals here in the United States, as well as what does that look like in other countries?
Sure. Well, there's some history here. In the United States, back in 1976, we passed a law called the Toxic Substances Control Act, known commonly as TSCA. And TSCA had two purposes. The overall goal was to protect people against chemicals, and it had two specific purposes. Number one, to require the testing of new chemicals before they came to market, and number two, to test the chemicals that were already on the market, test them for safety, test them for their potential to cause damage to human health. TSCA never fulfilled its promise. It was gutted within a year of its passage. The 62,000 chemicals that were then on the market were simply presumed to be safe and given a free pass. And in the 40 years since the passage of the bill, 42 years, only five chemicals have been removed from the market. Now, a year and a half ago, in 2016, the Congress passed a new chemical safety bill. It's called the Senator Frank Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act. The purpose of this nice piece of new legislation was to fix the problems with TSCA. And up until a year and a half ago, it was moving forward. It was establishing lists of high-priority chemicals. It was moving forward with requirements. That's mostly come to a halt under the current administration of the U.S. EPA. And right now, chemicals are largely unregulated in this country. Europe has done a much better job than we have. In 2007, the European Union passed legislation that requires the chemicals be tested, and they have aggressively pulled some chemicals off the market that threaten to harm children's health. One consequence of the imbalance between the European and the American regulations is that some of the multinationals are now marketing products in the U.S. that they can no longer market in Europe. In other words, the United States has become a chemical dumping ground.
Right. Well, we have a few more minutes. I have a list of chemicals that my friends gave me to get your quick thoughts on. And the first one I'm always interested in is these antibacterial lotions. Mm-hmm. What's your suggestion, recommendation with respect to the use of antibacterial lotions with kids?
They're good. They certainly clean a person's hands. They quell the spread of germs. Like anything else, if you overuse them, they can cause harm. They can cause cracking and peeling of the skin, which isn't good at all. But they have a purpose, yes.
Okay. How about sunscreens?
Absolutely important. Rates of skin cancer are steadily increasing in this country, especially among people with blonde, red hair, light complexion, blue eyes. Every single year, the deaths from melanoma increase, and melanoma is directly caused by solar ultraviolet. And so it's very important that people use sunscreen, wear proper hats, wear long-sleeve shirts. Too much sun is very dangerous, and sunburns in childhood are especially dangerous because if you damage cells when a person is very young, that person has 50, 60, 70 years to develop a cancer in later life. So I'm a strong advocate of sunscreen.
Okay.
And, you know, one thing we hear about with sunscreens a lot, there's a lot of question about the chemicals in them. Are there specific chemicals that you would avoid in a sunscreen or things that you should look for?
What I would do, that's an important question. What I would do is I would go to a trusted website like EWG, the Environmental Working Group, and they have categorized sunscreens as to the safer ones and the less safe ones. But I caution again, it's very important to use sunscreen. Don't get caught up in worries about chemicals and allow your children to get sunburned and then increase their risk for cancer. You got to use the right sunscreen.
Okay.
All right. I mean, all of this can be overwhelming, obviously, to moms, to parents, to expectant moms. You know, chemicals are pervasive in our society. And like you say, doctor, they provide lots of benefits, too. But
yes. Absolutely.
What is the takeaway here is the precautionary principle in play for most of these chemicals?
Yeah, I would say there are two takeaways from our book. The first is that chemicals are indeed pervasive in our society, and they can indeed cause damage to children, and people need to know about that. They can't just pretend it's not there. But the second thing, this book, we wrote this book very deliberately with the intention of empowering parents with knowledge, to give people the information that they need to take smart steps to protect their children, to protect their families against toxic chemicals. And we think that with application of the common sense approaches that we lay out in this book, that people can do a great deal to reduce the risk of their families to toxic chemicals.
You know, I have to add to that, the book is laid out, as Chris mentioned, with these series of questions by chapter. And it covers a lot of things that you may wonder about on a day-to-day basis, questions right. You ask yourself. Do I need to worry about the radiation from my cell phone? Do I need to worry about the chemicals in my couch?
The Teflon
Do I need to worry
in my
about
Teflon,
the Teflon
pan.
In my pan? Right. And so it's all just laid out here in a pretty straightforward, informative way.
Yeah, that's what we tried to do, absolutely. Yeah.
And yeah, so I would definitely recommend it for that reason.
The title of the book is Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know. The authors are Dr. Philip Landrigan and his wife, Mary Landrigan. Congratulations on collaborating, husband and wife.
Thank you. Thank you. We only had a few fights.
good for you. Thanks again. And we highly recommend the book. It's available at stores everywhere. Thanks again, Dr. Landrigan, for taking the time.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, we'll talk to Peter Metcalf. He's the CEO emeritus of Black Diamond Equipment. We want to get his thoughts on the outdoor show.
Outdoor retail.
That too.
And thank snow you. Show.
Yeah, very. Thank you.
There it is.
Thank you for saving it. Peter will join us right after these words from our underwriters. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us here in the studio for the second half of the show is Peter Metcalf. He is the founder and the CEO emeritus of Black Diamond Equipment. And he's here to talk about the remarks he gave at the annual Outdoor Retailer and Snow Show this year in Denver, as well as a little bit about a new documentary about our public lands and shrinking national monuments. So, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nell, and thanks, Chris. Good to be here this morning.
We always appreciate you making the time when you're here in town to fill us in on the latest. So the annual Outdoor Retailer Show, I think we talked about this last year, just made its move from Salt Lake to Denver, motivated by the outdoor industry saying, we don't agree with the policies that Utah has regarding the environment. What was the response to that this year in Denver? What was the feel?
Well, I should begin by saying it wasn't necessarily full agreement about moving the show. That was the general sentiment, but there was concerns about moving it, how would that work, et cetera. But I will share with you that it was such a relief to be in Denver. I mean, for me, it was a combination of melancholy, surrealism, and absolute inspiration and affirmation of the decision, especially after the decision and the action by the president at the urging of the congressional delegation to take down the two monuments. There was this sense of, had we had this show still in Utah, we'd be coming, it'd be feel like we were going to a funeral or to a morgue. And instead, we were in Denver. I had a place that really embraced our policies, had a simpatico set of values, had great attendance by the governor, Senator Michael Bennett, Governor Meade of Wyoming came down. But just a great sense of being in a state where the leadership and the community shares the values of all Americans and of our industry versus being in a state that is really becoming a pariah state, a rogue type of leadership that is foisting this Ebola virus of public lands policy onto the rest of the country. So people were energized by it and excited to be there and excited to see such an overwhelmingly positive response.
And you mentioned the governor's presence at the gathering. What were his comments?
Very affirmative to us being there, very much aligned with what our values are, which is that America's public lands are protected, zoned, funded, stewarded public lands are one of America's best ideas, and that they are accretive to the economic vibrancy of the West. They are accretive to the vibrancy of communities. They are an integral part of the quality of life that we all so value. And the governor spoke to that and was thrilled that we were there and thrilled that we were rewarding a state who created a statewide holiday to celebrate and affirm the role that public lands have in the state of Colorado versus a state like Utah, which when Colorado did that, agreed to fund $6.5 million on a bill to look at trying to expropriate the public lands for the state of Utah.
Well, and let's be clear, there are national monuments and lots of national parks in Colorado, too. I don't think the governor or his administration is championing the idea of reducing the public land ownership in Colorado, correct?
That's correct. I mean, right. He went the exact opposite route of leading the legislature in creating this National Public Lands Day in the state of Colorado.
Wow.
And I should add that when we made the decision to pull the show after the governor of Utah, Governor Herbert, refused to have any discussions with us about the state's plans to take down the monuments or to defund the lawsuit to take over the public lands, it was really inspiring to us to get calls from the political leadership, the governors and senators of Nevada, Montana, Colorado, New Mexico, wanting to showcase what they're doing in support of public lands so that our industry would consider bringing this very large and very important trade show to their state.
That's pretty impressive, especially from some other, you know, equally conservative states.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so this is not, these issues aren't per se partisan. They should be bipartisan. And yes, these other states are very much red or purple as opposed to blue.
And let's talk about the numbers associated with the show, you know, the economics associated with having a show like this in Denver. What does it mean to Denver?
It's huge. I mean, if you want to talk about the straight dollars, what the state of Utah themselves acknowledged was that the trade show in its current configuration was bringing in about $45 million a year, because it's twice a year, in direct spending. That's not the multiplier effect, direct spending to the state of Utah. What they don't talk about so much is that the same producers of our show had just signed a letter of intent to bring another important recreational trade show to the state of Utah. It's called the Bike Show. It's a very large bike show. It was down in Las Vegas. That was going to be about another $30 million a year in direct spending. So just in direct spending, the decision by the political leadership of the state of Utah not to back away from this Ebola virus set of public lands policies cost the state about $500 million in direct spending in 7 years. But I think what's more important than that is, or as important, is the fact that you lose the showcasing of your state, the highlighting of your state to people from all over the world who come for a trade show and see what's here in the way of business opportunities, future recreation, and that sort of thing. And as I think you guys know, I was instrumental in bringing the trade show to Utah over 20 years ago and bringing Black Diamond to Utah 27 years ago. When I did that, there was no outdoor industry. There was no ski manufacturing industry. And in that period of time, because of getting the trade show here and bringing Black Diamond here, a very vibrant industry grew up. And the point I'm making here is the trade show departs, your ability to showcase your state, your business community to many other business people and the ski industry and the outdoor industry is lost. And the reasons that we lost it is not accretive to promoting the state as a place to bring businesses like this.
Right, and let's be clear. You came to Utah. You're a New York boy, Long Island kid.
Yeah.
But you came to Utah and started your business here in Utah for a reason, because of the outdoor, because of the love of nature.
Well, I actually started the business back in the 80s in California, but even in creating it, I said to the people who were joining me that we'd only be here a very short period of time. What we were going to do was do a very systematic search of the West and find a location in the West that would reside on the asset side of the balance sheet and be accretive with the vision I had for the company, which was to be, quote, one with the sports we serve, absolutely indistinguishable from that. And after doing this systematic search, we picked Utah because it had so many of the attributes that we were looking for and were very proud to make the move here.
We're speaking with Peter Metcalf. He is the founder of Black Diamond Equipment and now the CEO emeritus of it. You're still involved with Black Diamond.
I am not really involved as of this year anymore. Oh. I have moved my work to public policy related issues, and I'm on the boards of several user advocacy groups, conservation groups, as well as several for-profit businesses, with the goal of trying to figure out how to bring them together in a synergistic fashion to advance a bipartisan agenda in the West in support of our public lands, which are a defining component of our high quality of life.
Are you encouraged by the work you're doing now in policy advocacy? Are you seeing
After
movement?
Leaving Colorado, after arriving and being there for a couple of days, I was so inspired.
Good.
Which was a bit of a nice juxtaposition to a set of feelings on leaving Utah after Trump had been here, taking down our monuments and seeing the bills that our legislature and our congressional delegation continue to put forth, and arriving in Colorado, meeting with the governor and senators and the industry and friends, I realized that, to use a metaphor, I felt like I had departed North Korea's political leadership, a pariah state, and arrived in South Korea. I mean, I felt that I realized suddenly that Utah's an outlier on this. It is not aligned with the rest of the country when it comes to our public lands at all. Mm. And so you can get depressed here. So this was inspiring, and I think that we're at a tipping point, though, because I look at the polling data that we have, and it shows that the majority of Utahns really do care about our public lands, about stewarding them, protecting them, funding them. So it's a matter of turning the public land issue into what I like to call a primary binary voting issue, just the way the NRA has made the Second Amendment a primary binary decision maker, or the Right to Life groups have done that. And we need to do that as well and make that a bipartisan issue.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to kind of transition on along these lines of policy outreach and education. You also shared with us a documentary that you recently worked on about the public lands here in Utah. So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in that and what that is.
It's very serendipitous. This documentary was a TV documentary for a European global TV network, kind of like the BBC, 10 million cable viewers. You can pick it up in the U.S., it's called Route 66, and this show has been on once a month. I mean, it airs every day, but every month they have a new segment, and it is about traveling along the U.S. highway, Route 66, doing stories culturally, politically, slice of life stories, 30 minutes in length, pertaining to 400 miles north or south of Route 66. And I think when the producer was researching issues and came up with the idea that this monuments debate in Utah really was a precedent. It was a huge issue in the West. And after doing some research, I guess my name kept, from what I heard, popping up when he Google searched it, and thought he would reach out to me and see whether or not I would be the host and help direct them on who to interview, where to go, what to see. And so I agreed to that, and just serendipitously, the timing when we began was the weekend that just before Donald Trump arrived, the big protest at the Capitol. So it was a fascinating time to get involved with these folks and spend a week interviewing many of the players and coming down through the landscapes and the communities that are around and part of both Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument, and Bears Ears National Monument.
What I'm most curious about with this is that, you know, you looked at both sides of the issue. You talked with those that oppose the monuments. What was that like? How did those conversations go? Were those people even receptive to talking to you?
There was, for sure, a little bit of discomfort at the outset.
I can imagine.
With that. But at the same time, you know, through my work of building a business that's very international in scope, I'm actually perhaps a more thoughtful guy than you might realize. And I really actually enjoyed sitting down in a non-public way, one-on-one across a table, and trying to engage people of a different set of beliefs to understand where they're coming from. And it was helpful. I mean, I think did develop a newfound appreciation for what some of their concerns are in their communities. I also, in the end, came away convinced that though they're real, not having the monuments there doesn't really help their case. What I understood really at the end of the day was that these battles, when you come right down to them, they're about fear of the, candidly, it's about fear of the future, that a way of life, ranching, the extractive industries, a small, tight-knit culture that has never had tourists or visitors, they want to remain that way. They've enjoyed being five generations where they're at in a small little community, nobody visiting, being ranchers, having their kids work in the mines. I mean, it's just a very nice, simple life. But the problem with that is that as much as we would all like things to sort of stay the same, their kids are going off to other places to get jobs, get well-educated, looking for work and new careers. The financial economics behind ranching as it's been done, or mining for coal, for example, they're changing. It's just not that viable. And the public, as the populations of the planet increase and people's interest in recreation increases, these beautiful public landscapes are attracting people. And whether there's a monument or not, they're going to come down. So the question isn't how do we stop time and protect the indigenous species from the invasive species. The real question is how do we acknowledge that, respect that, honor those traditions, and then help those people in those communities and help those communities transition to where they're going for a very bright and vibrant future, economically, socially, community-wise. And that's where there needs to be thoughtful dialogue and engagement as opposed to political leadership pandering to the past and thinking that we can bring back the glory days of uranium mining, coal mining, and ranching, when that's not the future for the state. It's not economically competitive. It's not sustainable. And there's no future to it.
One of the things that Phil Lyman said to you in the documentary,
San Juan County Commissioner?
Commissioner.
Yeah.
Was, you know, you want to protect this place, we want to protect this place,
yeah.
But, you know, we see this different kind of protection. And one thing that I've often wondered is if the folks that live there, and like you said, they like the quiet town and that small town atmosphere and their family's history of ranching, how do they feel about some of the energy extraction practices that leave such long-lasting scars and so heavily change the landscape?
Yeah, those are great questions. So as you may have caught in that documentary, I debated Phil a little bit over this issue because I think for a couple of reasons. Number one is that there's always this sort of cry out on the right about we're overregulated. Job-killing regulations are the last thing we need. And as I shared with him, we might not want job-killing regulations, but we sure like people protecting protections. And that's what a lot of this is about, is how do we protect and preserve a landscape that we all love? How do we protect people's health and wellness from pollution? And the documentary already began where we started shooting. My thought was, let's do it up in Moab, because you come into Moab and you look at a Superfund tailing site of toxic carcinogenic material that is a 10-year now in process project of railroading that stuff away to someplace else to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars at taxpayer expense. So there's a place where we privatize the profit, we socialize the losses along with the health impact on people. But then coming back to this issue, I think the difference really for Phil is that, I mean, I do believe that the people in San Juan County love those landscapes. I think they would like to continue using the public landscapes that all Americans enjoy as their own private backyard to use just for themselves as the way they have, and a very small number of people using the landscapes. The landscapes can absorb that however they want to use it, but it can't with more people coming down, and those more people are coming down, so you need a more thoughtful methodology to protect it. I think when it comes down to the extractive industries, they have been able to rationalize and accept the fact that, yes, extractive industries will desecrate some of the landscape, but the landscape is big enough to handle some desecration and some protection.
And based on the conversation with Phil Lyman you had, and another gentleman,
Bruce Adams, the county commissions.
There is a, obviously, no surprise, a deep distrust and deep animus towards the federal government. And that Mr. Adams talked about how the federal government has, quote unquote, reneged on every treaty and every agreement and every proposition that they've ever offered up and put in place, not to just the ranchers and the loggers and the but to Native Americans themselves. That's the argument they fashion, that the federal government, that they love the environment down there as much, but they want that love on their terms, to be carried out on their terms. And so, you know, if the federal government will just get out of the way, things could maybe work a little better. Do you see a role?
I mean, there's no question that if one wants to be absolutely candidly honest, my own belief is that you just nailed what the real issue is. The real issue is that, and I've had some of these other discussions when I've been down there and other times, is that I think it comes down to basically a strong belief that, look, my great-granddaddy, five times removed, came down here on orders of Brigham Young, left Salt Lake to come down to the desert and have dominion over this landscape. Mm-hmm. Yes, there were Native Americans there, but they were leaving the landscapes as they were. They were not turning them into a productive area. So we came down here and did some irrigation and ranched and took control of these landscapes. And we came out here to create the Kingdom of Zion. This wasn't even part of America. This was part of the Spanish Empire at the time. And the U.S. government bought this a few years later and then told us now we're part of America. And there is a long history of animosity over the federal government and the control it tries to exercise over Utah when they feel very much that, hey, this is ours. It's not the federal government. And that manifests itself in arguments over when Utah became a state, it was supposed to give up, the federal government was supposed to give up all rights to these lands and they should be ours. And I'm just reminded very much of a Faulkner quote, which is, the past is never dead. It is not even past. And at its core, mm-hmm. it is this ideology, this very anti-federal ideology, and this idea that we should run and manage this area for ourselves in the way we see fit. We live here. The federal government doesn't. But the challenge with that is that these lands belong to all Americans. They don't just belong to the people who've been there for five generations in San Juan County. And I should add that I respect and appreciate what they had to say, but at the same time, there's a whole new group of people there that feel very, very different and are at odds with that attitude.
Mm.
Well, we have just a couple minutes to wrap up here. Do you see the tide turning when you look at these conservation or public lands issues on a national scale?
On a national scale, I really do. I think we've hit a tipping point. And coming out of that trade show, seeing the political support, seeing Republican senators now beginning to, in the West, shift to supporting public lands, seeing Utah's attempt to export its Ebola-like public lands policies to other states failing, and Governor Herbert and the congressional delegation not getting support for that, Utah's being isolated. And my goal, and those I work with, is to not only have that continued, but to change that from within at a grassroots level so that we have leadership that understands and respects and acts upon the wishes of the majority of Utahns, which is to protect, steward, fund, and appropriately zone our public lands for future generations so they can have the benefits of these magnificent public lands that are so important to our quality of life that we have had and our parents have had.
Peter Metcalf, he's the founder of Black Diamond Equipment, CEO emeritus of that, now doing a lot of work in other areas in environmental policy, advocacy, et cetera. Hey, the documentary. Is there a website for that, or how best to find that?
Yeah, there is a YouTube site for it, and I don't have it in front of me to give you because it's off the air now. It aired every day during January, but you can pick it up off the YouTube site.
Yeah.
And I can get it to you, and maybe the next show you
can. I'm sure if we search on your name and Route 66. Or
yeah, it would come right up.
I'm testing that out right now.
All right.
If you Google Route 66, Peter Metcalf, it hits the first match.
Perfect. It's a great time. It's 25 minutes. Very insightful. Good interviewing skills, too, Peter. Way to go. You should have a show.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed being
here,
Peter. With you guys.
As always. Thanks, Peter. Let's take one last break for some underwriters. When we come back, it's time to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you. Support for KPCW comes from the Natural History Museum of Utah, a nonprofit organization, presenting a lecture by Michael Pollan discussing biomimicry in architecture, February 27th, 7 p.m. at the museum. The museum is located just minutes from Park City in Salt Lake's Foothill Cultural District. Information about the Pollan lecture at nhmu.utah.edu.
Welcome to This Green Earth. It's time to kind of wrap things up. Thanks again to our guests. First, Peter Metcalf, as always, pleasure to chat with him about the National Monument issues, public lands, and the annual outdoor retailer and snow show, which also has a summer element to it, right? And that's also going to be in Denver. Nod your head. That's right. Okay.
Yes.
And also the thanks to Dr. Philip Landrigan about his book titled Children, Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know.
We also, of course, want to thank the sponsors and the underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course, listeners like you. You help make this show possible with your thoughts and ideas too, which you can send us to.
That's right.
Send to.
Email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org with your suggestions.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM in Park City. We've got your Wasatch back. And now here's NPR News.